Chapter 2. A warm heart, a cool head, and clean hands. Vladimir Putin fulfilled his dream of joining the KGB in the summer of 1975, but he never became the secret agent of his childhood imagination. His induction was routine, aside from a comic miscommunication that occurred when he appeared that spring before the University Employment Commission that assigned graduates their careers in the Soviet system. An official from the university's law department announced that he would be joining the Leningrad Bar after all. Only then did a KGB officer monitoring the assignments stir in the corner of the room. "Oh no," the officer said. "That question has already been decided." Vladimir did not even know his assignment, but he was delighted. "Let's go," he told his childhood friend, Viktor Boryshenko, after picking him up in his car. It was clear to Boryshenko that something important had happened, but Vladimir would not so much as hint at what it was. They went to a Georgian restaurant near the Kazan Cathedral, the colonnaded landmark on Nevsky Prospect, eating chicken and walnut sauce, and, to Boryshenko's surprise, for his friend had never before allowed the indulgence, drinking shots of sweet liqueur. Only much later did he learn that they had been celebrating his friend's acceptance into the KGB. By the time Vladimir joined, the KGB had grown into a vast bureaucracy that oversaw not only domestic and foreign intelligence matters, but also counterintelligence at home and abroad, military counterintelligence, enforcement of the border and customs, and physical protection of the political leadership and government facilities like the country's nuclear sites. There were directorates that oversaw communications and cryptography, and that monitored telephone calls. The Sixth Directorate monitored economic security by policing speculation, currency exchanges, and other signs of deviant free market activity. The Fifth Chief Directorate, created in 1969 to protect the Constitution, enforced party loyalty and harassed dissidents in all walks of life. The KGB was more than just a security agency. It was a state within the state, ever in search of enemies within and without. It ostensibly served the interests of the Communist Party and acted on its orders, but its vast powers also served as a check on the party's power. Vladimir went to work at the Secretariat of the Directorate, the personnel office of the KGB's Leningrad headquarters, housed in the same building on Litieny Prospect that he had visited as a teenager. Only now he was no Johann Weiss infiltrating the ranks of a foreign power. It was a time of relative peace, and the Soviet Union at the time was at war only with itself. He was a junior bureaucrat, 23 years old, pushing papers at work and still living at home with his parents without a room of his own. His was a drab office, populated by balding veterans of Stalin's times who were old enough to remember the Gulag, if not the terror of 1937. The young agent claimed to question the old ways, but he never rebelled against the KGB, certainly not in a way that would undermine his budding career by, as the saying went, sticking out his ears. After his initiation at a desk, he attended officer training at school number 401 in Leningrad, one of the KGB's regional training academies. Located inside a heavily guarded six-story building near where the Okhta River meets the Neva, the school was a kind of submarine, where cadets immersed themselves in classroom studies and physical training, cut off from the rest of society. For 6 months, he learned basic intelligence tactics, including interrogation techniques. The KGB's ranks had swollen under Yuri Andropov, who served as its chairman from 1967 until 1982, when he became the paramount leader of the Soviet Union. Andropov became one of Vladimir's heroes, a distant and yet revered leader. Andropov understood the limits of the Soviet system and sought to modernize it so it could catch up to the West, especially in economic affairs. The KGB sought out recruits who understood macroeconomics, trade, and international relations. Vladimir seems to have anticipated this with his studies at Leningrad State University, where he wrote a thesis on the principle of most favored nation status in international trade. Andropov wanted to turn the KGB into an elite cadre, and Vladimir was a believer. He represented a new generation in the KGB, the post-Stalin generation of recruits who were thought to be less ideological, too young to remember the horrors of Stalin's regime. Andropov was viewed, within the Soviet context, as a reformer, despite his involvement in repression at home and abroad. He had been the Soviet ambassador to Budapest during the Hungarian uprising in 1956 and was haunted for the rest of his life by the swift violence that could erupt and threaten one-party rule. He watched in horror from the windows of his embassy as officers of the hated Hungarian security service were strung up from lampposts. This Hungarian complex shaped Andropov's belief that only force, wisely administered, could ensure the survival of the Soviet state and empire. Thus, while Andropov might have wanted to modernize the Soviet system, he ruthlessly punished dissent against it. It was he who created the notorious Fifth Chief Directorate to combat ideological opposition, which led to the persecution of the physicist Andrei Sakharov and the author Alexander Solzhenitsyn. It was he who, in 1969, created a network of psychiatric hospitals to persecute dissidents by classifying opposition to the state as evidence of mental illness. Vladimir, blinkered by official propaganda or by indifference, rationalized and romanticized the KGB's work. He believed the intelligence officer was the defender of law and order. In the summer of 1976, he emerged from the KGB's academy as a first lieutenant. He did not return to the personnel department, but rather to the counterintelligence department, the KGB's second chief directorate. He took part in operations not against the enemy outside, but against the enemy within. He became an apparatchik who sought, above all, to maintain social order and political control, though very little was known about his activities at the time. His friends, and even his colleagues, could never be sure exactly what he did, and he went to great lengths for many years to keep the details of his work secret. An officer who worked with him later stated, as a matter of fact, that he worked for the Fifth Chief Directorate, but no one could be certain. Although Vladimir would deny it, his colleague believed he was intimately familiar with the tactics the KGB employed against critics of Soviet power, including Solzhenitsyn and later Sakharov. Certainly one of his closest friends in Leningrad, Viktor Cherkesov, became notorious for his work in the Fifth Chief Directorate against dissidents, including religious believers. And he felt no remorse or reservation about the KGB's reliance on informants or collaborators. Although they sowed distrust throughout Soviet society, he believed that collusion with a feared police state not only was not wrong, but rather was essential to maintaining order. 90% of the KGB's intelligence, he once claimed, derived from ordinary Soviet citizens willingly or otherwise informing on others, their co-workers, their friends, their relatives. "You cannot do anything without secret agents," he said. Vladimir evidently collected and controlled agents during his stint in counterintelligence in Leningrad, especially businessmen, journalists, and athletes who had traveled abroad or met with visiting foreigners. Though his activities remain shrouded in secrecy even now, he had become something closer to the cop his coach had warned he would become if he went to law school. He lived a double life, but a far less dramatic and dangerous one than that of the shield and the sword. It was among this cadre that he forged friendships with men who worked with him in the shadows and would do so for years to come. Viktor Cherkesov, Alexander Bortnikov, Viktor Ivanov, Sergei Ivanov, and Nikolai Patrushev. In this close, closed circle of friends, all men, he found camaraderie, among like-minded officers who reinforced what would become a stark, black-and-white view of the world. After 6 months in counterintelligence, Vladimir transferred to the KGB's first chief directorate, responsible for intelligence operations beyond the Soviet Union's borders. It was considered the KGB's elite branch. Of nearly 300,000 employees of the security apparatus, fewer than 5,000 served in the department. His study of German no doubt helped him land the post, and the KGB enabled him to continue to study 2 hours a day, 3 times a week. Still, he did not become a spy, and he did not go abroad. He remained in the big house on Letieny Prospect, responsible for shadowing foreign visitors and diplomats stationed in the city's consulates. Much of the work was analytical, and it was hardly demanding. As the Soviet Union's second city, Leningrad was not exactly a backwater posting, but it lacked the cloak-and-dagger intrigues that swirled around the capital, Moscow. The KGB itself had begun to succumb to bloat and sclerosis, its swelling ranks resulting in a reduction of efficiency. For many agents, the youthful enthusiasm for the world of espionage inevitably succumbed to tedium and bureaucratic inertia. It's only in fiction that a lone man can take on the whole world, a contemporary, Yuri Shvets, wrote of the era. Vladimir seemed content to toil in the lower ranks. Though described by one of his superiors as meticulous in his work, he displayed no driving ambition to climb through the organization. In 1977, his father retired from the train factory and, as a disabled war veteran, received a small two-bedroom apartment, not even 300 square feet, on Stachek Prospect in Avtova, a newly reconstructed district south of Leningrad's historic district. The city's post-war housing crunch was such that many families still lived in communal housing. Even officers of the KGB did not automatically qualify for an apartment. And yet now, at 25, for the first time in his life, Vladimir had his own bedroom, his own little corner, as Vera Gurevich called it. With abundant free time, he careered around the city in the car his mother had given him, and, according to his friends, continued to involve himself in street fights, despite the risks such indiscretions could cause his career. He was indifferent to risk and danger. He proudly recounted a poor performance evaluation that said as much, in part because his KGB service provided him some protection from the ordinary police. He bent the rules because he could. One Easter, he took Sergei Roldugin, a classical musician who became a close friend, to a religious procession that he had been assigned to monitor, policing the faithful, people like his own mother. He impressed his friend by taking him to see the altar of the church, access to which was prohibited to laymen, suggesting that Putin had little reverence for the sanctity of the church. "Nobody can go there, but we can," he told his friend. He was reckless and temperamental. On the way home from their church tour, as Roldugin recalled, a cluster of drunken students at a bus stop accosted them for a cigarette. Vladimir, clearly an unintimidating presence, rebuffed them so rudely that one shoved him. Putin threw him over his shoulder as if it were a match in the judo club. He told his friends he was a police officer with the Interior Ministry, and many, it seems, believed it. Soon, though, it became harder to disguise his actual position. Roldugin, who met him in 1977, quickly discerned the truth. It made him wary. As a musician, he had traveled abroad on visits monitored by KGB operatives barely disguised as officials of the Ministry of Culture. Roldugin disliked these ideological minders and learned not to speak freely around them. And yet, here he was, becoming friends with one of them. Vladimir disarmed him finally by admitting his true profession, though even then Roldugin found it impossible to draw him out further. "I play the cello," he once told his friend. "I could never be a surgeon. Still, I'm a good cellist. But what is your profession? I know you're an intelligence officer. I don't know what that means. Vladimir humored him, but only a little. I'm a specialist in human relations, he said cryptically, and then refused to talk about it anymore. By 1979, Vladimir reached the rank of captain and was, at last, sent to Moscow to attend the KGB's higher school, which was named after Felix Dzerzhinsky, the founder of the Soviet secret police. Dzerzhinsky remained a revered cult figure in the KGB, whose training manuals quoted his description of the intelligence officer's essential characteristics: a warm heart, a cool head, and clean hands. At last, the first chief directorate seemed to be grooming him for service abroad. And yet, after a short course, he again returned to Leningrad and resumed the task of monitoring foreigners, with uncertain success. One supervisor described his work as extremely productive, but the senior KGB official in Leningrad during his career, Oleg Kalugin, said that the agency failed to uncover a single foreign spy on the loose in the city. His career seemed to stall just as the Soviet Union's relative period of peace and détente began to face increasing turmoil at home and beyond. In retrospect, the first signs of the decay and ultimate collapse of the Soviet Union. In December 1979, the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan after a bloody coup orchestrated by Andropov's KGB and carried out by the military's elite commandos wearing Afghan uniforms. The invasion began a futile operation to support the communist government in Kabul that would cost the lives of thousands of soldiers, whose bodies were brought home in zinc boxes known by the code name Cargo 200 and kept shrouded in secrecy. The election of Ronald Reagan as President of the United States in November 1980 further inflamed Cold War tensions and pushed the two superpowers ever closer to confrontation. The Kremlin and the KGB soon became obsessed with what Soviet leaders believed to be Reagan's plans to launch a preemptive nuclear strike against the Soviet Union. At a conference in May 1981, an already ailing Leonid Brezhnev denounced Reagan as a threat to world peace, while Andropov announced that henceforth the ultimate priority of the security services was to uncover evidence of Reagan's plan to destroy the country. This vast operation, codenamed Ryan after the Russian for nuclear missile attack, Raketno-Yadzhennoe Napadenie, became the principal intelligence effort of KGB bureaus around the world and remained a paranoid obsession for the rest of the decade. Soon, Vladimir Putin would play his part in it. In 1980, after he returned to Leningrad, Vladimir's personal life and career took an important turn. Unusually for Soviet society, he remained unmarried at 28. His bachelorhood was ill-suited to the conservative KGB. The first chief directorate, in fact, refused to post single men abroad, fearing that sexual liaisons outside marriage could leave them vulnerable to exposure or blackmail. Vladimir was not unattractive, with deep blue eyes. He was fit and quick-witted, if sardonically so. When it came to women, though, he seemed emotionally reticent, even stunted. He was far more at ease with a circle of male friends from his youth in the KGB. I often used to tell him that he was terrible at making conversation, Roldugin said. Late in his university years, Vladimir had had his first serious relationship with a medical student. Her name was Lyudmila Kmarina, whose brother, Viktor Kmarin, was also a close friend. Roldugin described her as pretty and headstrong, inclined less to ask how Vladimir felt than to tell him when he was ill. They met at his family's dacha in Tosna and dated through graduation and the launch of his career. In 1979, they became engaged. They applied for a marriage license, and their parents bought rings, a suit, and a dress. And then suddenly he broke off the relationship. He decided it was better to suffer then than to have both of us suffer later. but he never explained what happened, not even to Roldugin. He would only hint at some intrigue, though it seemed not to have been especially bitter, since he would remain friends with her brother Victor for years to come. Vladimir had grown used to the bachelor's life, perhaps preferred it as a pampered son still living at home. He assumed he might never marry. In March 1980, however, he met another Lyudmila, Lyudmila Shkrebneva, a blue-eyed stewardess for Aeroflot, who lived in Kaliningrad, the former Prussian province seized by the Soviet Union after the Nazi defeat. She was 22 and had blonde hair that flowed in waves to her shoulders. She and another stewardess, Galina, visited Leningrad for 3 days. On their first night in town, eager to take in as many of the city's sights as possible, they went with Galina's boyfriend, Andrei, to the Lensovet Theater to see a performance by Arkady Rykin, an aging actor and satirist. Galina had invited Lyudmila, and so Andrei brought along his friend, Vladimir. Lyudmila was initially unimpressed, noting his shabby clothes and unprepossessing demeanor. Had she met him on the street, she recalled, she would not have paid attention to him. During the intermission, though, she grew bold and asked if he could help them acquire tickets to the musical performance the next night. He did, and by the end of the second night, he gave her his telephone number. Andrei was shocked. "Are you crazy?" he asked his friend later. He had never before seen him give his number to someone he did not know well. They met again the third night, and when she returned to Kaliningrad, she called the number. When she flew again to Leningrad in July, they began a relationship. She joked that other girls took the bus or trolley to dates, while she flew to hers. Soon, she resolved to move to Leningrad. Vladimir urged her to return to college. She had dropped out of a technical college to become a stewardess, and she enrolled in the philology department at his alma mater, Leningrad State University. The stress of the move and the studies ruptured their relationship at first, and she broke it off until he flew to Kaliningrad and persuaded her to return. By October, she had settled in a communal apartment that she shared with a woman whose son had left to serve in the army. Vladimir proved to be a demanding, jealous boyfriend. She felt he was always watching her, testing her, judging her. He would declare his intention, whether it was to go skiing, say, or for her to take a typing course, and leave her no room to argue. Unlike the first Lyudmila, she was more pliant. When Vladimir's mother met her, she was not impressed, and worse, told her so. Her son already had another Lyudmila, Maria huffed, a good girl. Lyudmila did not know he worked for the KGB. He had told her, too, that he worked for the Criminal Investigations Branch of the Ministry of the Interior. It was a common cover for intelligence agents, and he had even been issued a false identification card. Whenever she asked what he did during the day, he evaded her questions with quips. "Before lunch, we caught," he told her once, as if he and his colleagues had spent the day fishing. "After lunch, we released." It was not until 1981, after they had been dating for a year and a half, that she learned his true employment. And even then, it was from the wife of a friend. She felt a tingle of excitement and pride. Unlike Roldugin, she had no reason to fear the KGB or this young man. His taciturn manner now seemed understandable, explaining what had seemed elusive. When her friend told her, it was a revelation, but also an unsettling one. Being with him meant accepting that a part of him would always remain beyond her grasp. It even occurred to her that the woman who had revealed his secret might well have been instructed to do so. She was never sure. Only then did she remember an odd encounter some months before. She had agreed to phone Putin one evening at 7 o'clock, as she often did. Because her communal apartment had no telephone, she went to a public telephone in a courtyard nearby. As it grew dark, she dialed his number, but he did not answer. She gave up, knowing his penchant for working late. As she was leaving, a young man approached her in the quiet, empty space. She turned to return to her apartment through the courtyard's arched entrance, and still he followed. He quickened his pace, and so did she.
"Young lady, please, I'm not doing anything bad. I only want to talk to you. Only 2 seconds."
He seemed sincere, speaking from the heart. She stopped.
"Young lady, it's fate. It's fate, how I wanted to meet you."
"What are you talking about?" she replied dismissively. "It's not fate."
"Well, please, I beg you, give me your telephone number."
"I don't have a telephone."
"Then write down mine," he said.
He was offering his number the way Putin had on their second date.
"I won't,"
she replied, before at last he let her go. The half-forgotten episode came back to her in a puzzling rush. Had the KGB, had Vladimir, tested her on the darkening street? If she were the type of woman who would strike up a relationship with any man on the street, that might provoke a husband's jealousy, exposing her or him to counter-espionage or blackmail. Or maybe he was just a brash young man who hoped to get to know her. She was not unnerved exactly, but now she grasped what kind of life she would enter with this man. Some might be afraid of such a test, she assured herself, but it would be silly to let it upset her. She had nothing to hide, after all. She did not resent his work. Work is work, she shrugged. But when she asked him about the encounter, more than once, he refused to answer, which did upset her. She knew he would never tell her anything about the other world he occupied, never put her mind at ease by explaining why he came home, say, at midnight instead of 9 o'clock. She would worry, then grow angry, but always have to wait, alone and unknowing. His work at the KGB would leave its mark on her. She could never speak of his job or be open with people about her life or theirs together. Marrying Putin would be a private ban on her own life, she knew. She fell in love with the man, slowly, but it felt oppressive. Vladimir could be bold and impetuous, but in courtship he dallied. He did use his position and his salary to travel with her. Twice they went to the Black Sea, which he had loved since his trip as a young student staring at the stars. They once drove with friends to Sochi, the resort town more than 1,000 miles to the south. They stayed in a two-room apartment reserved for the guards of Bacharov Ruche, the seaside mansion built on the orders of Nikita Khrushchev in the 1950s for the Soviet elite, and that one day in the unforeseeable future would become the retreat of the presidents of a new Russia. Leonid Brezhnev convalesced there in the listless final years of his rule. From the balcony of their room, they could see the beach, but access to it was forbidden. In 1981, they returned to the Black Sea, this time staying 2 weeks in Sudak, on the Crimea, their first trip alone. It was hardly a whirlwind romance, though. When at last he asked her to marry him, it was April 1983. And she thought he was breaking off the relationship. "In 3.5 years, you have probably made up your mind," he told her at his apartment.
"Yes," she said, hesitantly, fearing the end. "I have made up my mind."
He seemed doubtful. "Yes," he replied, and then added, "Well, then, if that's the way it is, I love you and propose that we get married." He had already settled on the date, July 28th, then only 3 months away. They had a civil ceremony, not a religious one, which would have been forbidden for a KGB officer, and then 2 wedding celebrations. 20 friends and relatives attended the first aboard a floating restaurant moored to the embankment beside Leningrad State University. A night later, they held a different gathering in a more private space, a banquet hall in the Moscow Hotel. To Lyudmila, the first was warm and joyful. The second was more ceremonial, pleasant enough, but a little bit different. In attendance were Vladimir's colleagues from the KGB,
who could not risk their confidentiality, even to the relatives and closest friends of one of their comrades. They honeymooned in Ukraine, first driving to Kyiv, where they met friends who traveled with them, often sharing a room. They toured Moldova, then Lviv in western Ukraine, Nikolaev, and finally Crimea, staying in Yalta, all holiday landmarks of the vast Soviet Empire. In Yalta, the newlyweds had a room of their own, and they stayed for 12 days, swimming and sunbathing on the rocky shore. Crimea seemed a magical, sacred place to him. They returned, via Moscow, so he could drop by the KGB headquarters, the center, as it was known, and then they moved into his parents' two-bedroom apartment on Stachek Lane. He was 30, she 25, and together they settled into a happy, if constrained, marriage. One colleague, Igor Antonov, believed Vladimir married to advance his career, knowing that bachelorhood would hold him back. He certainly seemed to have thought it all out carefully, and his career break came a year later. The KGB promoted him to major after 9 years of service and sent him to study in Moscow at the elite school of foreign intelligence, the Red Banner Institute. Founded in 1938, it was boot camp for the Soviet Union's foreign spies. The institute was not only ideologically exclusive, it also discriminated on racial and ethnic lines. Jews were banned, as were Crimean Tatars, Chechens, and Kalmyks. Religious practice of any sort was forbidden. His admission may well have resulted from the KGB's version of affirmative action. By the 1980s, the first chief directorate began to complain that too many of its cadets were the spoiled children of privileged parents, who used their influence and connections in Moscow to gain entry. Instead, it wanted robust candidates with an aptitude for languages and absolute devotion to the Soviet cause. The directorate tried to expand its recruiting pool by increasing the proportion of cadets from the provinces, asking regional headquarters to nominate young officers. Leningrad sent Vladimir Putin. The institute was now named after Andropov. After his long reign at the helm of the KGB, he took over as the Secretary General of the Communist Party after Brezhnev's death in 1982, raising the hopes of those who wanted to modernize the state under the firm hand of the security services. Instead, Andropov served only 15 months before he died suddenly in February 1984, beginning a tumultuous turnover of geriatric Soviet leaders. Konstantin Chernenko replaced Andropov just months before Vladimir began attending the Red Banner Institute, and barely survived a year before dying in March 1985. The great Soviet nation suddenly seemed unable to generate new leaders, lumbering through a period of economic and political stagnation that left it falling even further behind the West and the main adversary, the United States. The Soviet war in Afghanistan had descended into a quagmire, and those in Vladimir's intelligence circles had the confidence to discuss truths about it that could never be uttered publicly. He was stunned by the revelations, having believed reflexively in the righteousness of the intervention. The institute was a secret facility located in a forest outside Moscow, where it remains today under a new name, the Academy of Foreign Intelligence. It offered courses that lasted 1 to 3 years, depending on a cadet's education, experience, and expected assignment. Lyudmila, now pregnant, remained in Leningrad, living with his parents. It was here that Vladimir learned spycraft, how to recruit agents, to communicate in code, to conduct surveillance, to lose a tail, to make and use dead letter boxes. Above all, he was learning the art of deep cover. Throughout the training, cadets adopted code names, derived from the first letter of their names. Putin became Comrade Platov, protecting his real identity even from other students. They wore civilian clothes, not uniforms, preparing for their futures posing as journalists, diplomats, or trade delegates in countries they would be expected to know intimately before having visited them. Vladimir showed up in September 1984, wearing a new three-piece suit, eager to impress, even though it was a warm fall day. "Look at Comrade Platov now," an instructor, Colonel Mikhail Frolov, told the other cadets, citing this slight young man as a model. At last, after nearly a decade of tedium monitoring foreigners and dissidents in Leningrad, he was learning the craft that he had imagined as a youth. The Institute's three main departments were headed, at the time, by veterans of the KGB's golden age of espionage, the years before, during, and after World War II. Yuri Modin in political intelligence, Ivan Shishkin in counterintelligence, and Vladimir Barkovsky in scientific and technological intelligence. All made their reputations as spies in London, and Modin was the last controller of the group that became known as the Magnificent Five, the young Cambridge graduates, including Kim Philby, who were recruited during the 1930s as agents of the Soviet Union, and ultimately penetrated the highest levels of British power. Although long since exposed and dismantled, the operation remained a model for young intelligence officers at the Institute. Comrade Platov was learning from the KGB's stars. On April 28, 1985, while still completing her university degree, Lyudmila gave birth to a daughter. She wanted to name her Natasha, but Vladimir had already made up his mind. She would be named Maria, or Masha, after his mother. He missed his daughter's birth, but after the mother and child were released from the hospital, he received a pass to visit and celebrated his new family with Sergei Roldugin, who became Maria's godfather, at the dacha of Roldugin's father near Viborg, by the Finnish border. Though she did not know it, Lyudmila herself was undergoing a thorough background check of her health and temperament. She learned of it only after she was summoned by the university administration office and told that she had been cleared of any suspicion. Vladimir was now an established family man at the most critical juncture in his life so far. His hopes for going abroad, for moving up to the elite work of foreign intelligence, depended on his success at the Red Banner Institute, and this was decidedly mixed. It was clear from his language immersion that he would serve in a German-speaking country. The only question was whether he would be assigned to the capitalist West, meaning West Germany, Austria, or Switzerland, or the Soviet satellite in the East, the German Democratic Republic. Serving undercover in the West would have required another year or two at the Institute, with deeper and deeper training in local customs that often betrayed foreign origins. Basic aspects of capitalist life, like mortgages, could stump and betray a Soviet operative. Vladimir would later claim that he preferred to serve in East Germany, but the choice was not his to make. The Institute's graduation commission decided on assignments based on performance and personal comportment. And despite the stakes, his behavior put it all at risk. He was able to return to Leningrad for short breaks, and during one of them, he again got into a fight, during a confrontation on the metro with a group of hooligans, as he recounted to Sergei Roldugin. This time, he suffered as much as those he confronted, breaking his arm in the fight. He told Roldugin there would be consequences, and indeed he was reprimanded, though he never explained the punishment to his friend. He has a fault which is objectively bad for the special services. "He takes risks," Roldugin said. "One should be more cautious, and he is not." His evaluation at the end of his year in training was mediocre. He did not suffer from excessive ambition. The word careerist was practically a slur in the Soviet system. But Colonel Frolov noted several negative characteristics. He was withdrawn and uncommunicative. While sharp-witted, he also possessed a certain academic tendency, a polite way of describing his pedantic manner. He did not have the family connections or background to grease the path to a prestigious posting.
The fight on the metro in Leningrad almost certainly contributed to the abrupt end of his studies at the Red Banner Institute. Instead of continuing for another 2 years of grooming for the elite ranks of spycraft, he left at the end of the first. And when he received his assignment, it was not to West Germany, but to the East. It was not even to Berlin, a hub of Cold War espionage since the defeat of the Nazis, but rather to Dresden, the provincial capital of Saxony, near the border with Czechoslovakia. For the first time, he received a foreign passport. He was almost 33 and had never left the Soviet Union before.